Is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Sri the Satsarupa Das Goswami, given on July 7, 1999, in Dublin, Ireland.
Ladies and gentlemen, it explains also why I'm staying in Ireland and not traveling, and why you therefore come here. It said I still am going from day to day with these debilitating headaches, and this morning I had one at 4:30, and I took one kind of medication. It didn't work. Then I took another at 5:30, and it didn't work until finally 7:30. I became clear. So I don't know, and I don't know when it'll come back again. But I think within these 2 days I should be able to come for the 2 or 3 classes, and maybe some afternoon. We can take an afternoon snack together. So I like the situation I have very much, living in Wicklow, for managing the health, and it's very peaceful there, and I'm able to write, and I'm able to read and chant, and I give some lectures too. Sometimes I go to Dublin and lecture, and I will be traveling this year too. I'll be going around August 22nd or so to Inishrath and stay there for a couple of weeks through Janmashtami, Vyas Pooj, and then I'll be going to Italy. I kind of promised to go somewhere in South Europe once a year, rather than I used to go to a number of countries. Now I'll just go to one. If anybody wants to come, they can see me there, or they can wait till I come to their country. And of course, England is an exception. I think on our way to Italy, we'll stay a day at your place, if that's all right. Yeah. And then next year, I plan to go to the Caribbean and America again. So it's not that I only stay in Inishrath, but it's definitely become like my home, Wicklow. And although it's enforced on me by health, I also have been taking by nature to the hermit-like existence that I live, and I like it. So the next point I want to bring up is, in a sense, connected to that. That the nature of living alone, and also the way I'm writing, especially in every day, just write, which I'm continuing to write now. This November it'll be 3 years that I'm writing this one thing and continuing to write it. Perhaps the main feature of it is that I'm trying to be honest, and repeated attempts at writing honest and being honest. And I can't say that by doing that I've become more honest, but I become aware when I'm not being honest, and when I develop a kind of persona. The word persona means, one meaning is a character in a novel or a play, but the second meaning, which comes from Jungian psychology, is the mechanism a person develops to hide his thoughts and feelings, especially in order to adapt or relate to the outer world. So we all do that, and people know us by a certain persona. They think that's Bhakti Ras, that's Anuradha, and it's partly because you project that self, but it may be not your real self, because you don't want to show your real self for so many different reasons. Maybe we've tried to show our real self and people don't like it. So we find a kind of self that by which we can get on better in the world. But in writing, the way I'm trying to write, I try to get past those kind of personas. Of course, personas aren't always bad things. The idea of playing a role. Like, say, I'm a sannyasi, so there's a persona of a sannyasi. But it's, if you count things like don't associate intimately with women, and you should be able to regularly speak on Krishna conscious themes and represent Prabhupada and Krishna, and every sannyasi should do that, it's kind of persona, or duty, or dharma, social role, social roles for husbands and wives and temple presidents and all kinds of roles that we have to carry out, because we do live in the world, And it's the way that we serve Krishna. But we should at least be aware that that's not, that I'm doing this as my duty, and my internal self, if there is a difference, what is the, who am I really, and how does this role fit me? Is this a role that I can actually carry out? The role that I am living. So, to speak about this personally, I notice a difference between the role of the lecturer, which is what a sannyasi does a lot. Not only sannyasi, many of you are also regularly lecturing. I notice the difference between that and when I'm writing, because mostly I'm writing, and that's like these. I have a stronger identification with that, which could also be said to be a persona. But I mean, self is inevitable. I'm not trying to escape self, but it seems that in the writing, I'm always trying to be directly honest and perhaps dismantle personas. I laugh at them if I see I'm playing a persona. I can laugh at it or question it. But when I'm lecturing, the duty is to speak perfect truth, as Prabhupada gives and as the Shastras give, and without so much discussion about how you are applying it yourself and whether you're succeeding or failing. It's not that an audience wants to hear confessions from you when it's the time for Bhagavad Gita class. They want to hear a faith-inspiring, knowledge-inspiring talk of Krishna consciousness. So you do it, you deliver it. But within yourself, you may see a gap. Sometimes the gap is so great that you're really not qualified to speak. If you don't follow the four rules and chant 16 rounds, how can you represent Krishna? So there are qualifications for speakers. But we should at least be aware of the gap. As a listener to lectures, I like it when the lecturer at least briefly makes some allusion to his own imperfection, and I can kind of relax and listen to him better, rather than if there's some kind of assumption that he's perfect and is telling everybody else what to do. So I was thinking in terms of the material that I'm going to present today that actually I don't have the final answer on this and what I'm presenting, and it's not necessarily wrong for a speaker to present material in that way. It can be done, and it can be bona fide, and it can be interesting that we're all trying to practice Krishna consciousness. We're all imperfect, and so, although the philosophy is, you could say, cut and dry, that it's exactly this way and this is what it should be, we admit that we are just trying to apply it. I attended one Bhakti Vriksha meeting here in Ireland, and I see the format there is set up more for that kind of open discussion among devotees, that the emphasis more is on the subjective, or you know, how I see it, how I'm practicing Krishna consciousness as a human being, and not to minimize the absolute truth, but to openly discuss the difference, you could say, between where I'm at and the absolute truth. So I think we need that kind of a discussion to feel relevancy and to feel truthfulness and just humanness. So with that in mind, I'll speak something, and let's see how it goes. This is from the teachings of Lord Kapila Dev to Devahuti. believe this is Lord Kapila speaking. Yes. Chapter 29 of the third canto, text 12. The manifestation of unadulterated devotional service is exhibited when one's mind is at once attracted to hearing the transcendental name and qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is residing in everyone's heart. Just as the water of the Ganges flows naturally down towards the ocean, such devotional ecstasy, uninterrupted by any material condition, flows towards the Supreme Lord. And I'm reading from the purport. He says, the flow of the Ganges water cannot be stopped by any condition. Similarly, a pure devotee's attraction for the transcendental name, form, and pastimes of the Supreme Godhead cannot be stopped by any material condition. The word avicchina, without interruptions, is very important in this connection. No material condition can stop the flow of the devotional service of a pure devotee. This reminds me of another verse, Savai Pum Sam Paro Dharmo, Hai Tukiya Priti Hita, that devotional service is done without interruption. And in that verse, it also says it's done without any motive other than pleasing Krishna. That's brought up here too. The word ahaituki means without reason. A pure devotee does not render loving service to the personality of Godhead for any cause or for any benefit, material or spiritual. This is the first symptom of unalloyed devotion. Anya vilasita shunyam. He has no desire to fulfill by rendering devotional service. Such devotional service is meant for the Purushottama, the Supreme Personality, not for anyone else. Avyahita means without cessation. A pure devotee must engage in the service of the Lord 24 hours a day without cessation. His life is so molded that at every minute, at every second, he engages in some sort of devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Another meaning of the word avyavahita is that the interest of the devotee and the interest of the Supreme Lord are on the same level. The devotee has no interest but to fulfill the transcendental desire of the Supreme Lord. Such spontaneous service unto the Supreme Lord is transcendental and is never contaminated by the material modes of nature. These are the symptoms of pure devotional service, which is free from all contamination of material nature. So this is a perfect stage of devotional service where you have no distractions. I'm going to take this off. No material desires. And you don't ever space out or fail to be thinking of Krishna and engaging in Krishna's service. So it's easy to say that, oh, I'm not at that level. But the thing I wanted to bring out today is that we should never forget that this is the goal, to have no separate interest than Krishna has. Now, I say this, and at the same time, I myself have I believe for myself, and I advocated for others, that we should engage our personal natures in devotional service and not censor them or think that they're forbidden, our psycho-physical nature, who we are now as human beings born in a certain culture and so on, these different drives and that we have. And this is also stated in the philosophy that you shouldn't kill desire, you should use it in the service of Krishna. Whatever you want to do, just do it for Krishna. If you reject material things, thinking that they cannot be used in Krishna's service, that's an immature renunciation. It's a kind of a phenomena in the history of the ISKCON membership, I think. At least I hear it a lot myself, of devotees who join the movement under certain conditions, including the condition that the movement was in at that time, and they were told to completely surrender, to submerge all personal interests and always engage in devotional service. And in one sense, they did it. They did that. Gave up their careers, put aside as maya things that they may have loved and thought were really a part of them. And just engage in devotional service. And 10, 20, 30 years later, are thinking quite differently about the thing. Either one reason is they may feel that all along they were misled by some leaders who themselves were impure and were just manipulative, where they were speaking the philosophy of complete surrender, themselves not surrendered completely, themselves with particular desires, and they would engage with devotees. And then the devotees feel later that, well, why was I told to give that up? I have such a tendency towards education or music or whatever it is, and this is who I am, and I was told that this was my, I was told to give my wife up and my children just because they weren't devotees, but that wasn't right that I did that, and this and that. And so are coming again to practice things that they like to do in Krishna's service. So, now, this is even advised as a proper way to engage. That's like this, the meaning of Varnashram Dharma, as a gradual way to gain renunciation and come gradually into full surrender to Krishna. For example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you should always think of me, like in this verse, in ecstatic absorption. But if you can't do that, he says in the 12th chapter, then follow the rules and regulations. And if you can't do that, do something else. So there's recognition by Krishna that here's what I want you to do. Sarva dhammam parityajamami kama saranam bhaja. But if you can't do it, these are the things you can do that will get you there. But don't ever think that these steps are the whole thing and stop along the way in those. But I wanted to just point out that while we're engaging our natures and Krishna's service in a way that is good for us and that is progressive, we should never forget the goal, and we should never resent what Krishna is asking us to do. Sometimes I have resented it, or I just can't seem to understand it. I've had some discussion about this with one of my god brothers, and I printed a letter about it at the end of Every Day Just Right. I think I heard that you discussed that in a disciples' meeting. Was it the devotees in England or somewhere else? Yeah, they read that letter and discussed it. The idea, well, Krishna does say, give up your personal interest, do just what the guru says, and just because he's a representative of Krishna. And that's the highest thing. That's better than doing your own thing for Krishna. Just come with a blank slate and do what you're told. How I know that translates into experience in ISKCON, I don't like the sound of it, but I should be careful not to resent Krishna saying that, just because this is the philosophy. Give up your interest. You should have no interest. Just try to please Krishna. That's the gopis' standard and all the residents of Vrindavan. But it seems to me, from the position we're in, we have to say that you can surrender to Krishna by not giving up, throwing away, burning up, flushing down the toilet, but rendering it, purifying it, doing it for Krishna, the things that are of your nature. And so this is a kind of a dialogue. Whereas in the philosophy, that's admittedly a lower standard, as represented in the verse Yat Karosi, Yat Jehosi, and higher standard is in the verse Sarva Dharmam Parityajna. I say that existentially or in reality, we shouldn't be told not to do Yat Karosi, do it, and do something, ask to do something impossible. Although I take that position, I admit that sometimes when I read it, I actually like resent. It kind of ruffles me that Krishna is asking this, and I wonder what is it like not to have any desire and just do whatever Krishna wants you to do. I remember having a talk with one of my god brothers about this. He was representing the superiority of the complete surrender. And to kind of reconcile it, he said, well, what you do is you go to the guru and you completely surrender to him to use you as an instrument. And he intelligently, knowing your nature, he engages in you in something that is according to your nature. That would be the reconciliation. But you don't go with the condition that I'm a computer expert and this is how I want to be engaged. I don't want to wash the bathrooms. And I don't want to go to India. And this is what I do. But just go and say, I'm your servant. And then he says, oh, why don't you do this? What you're so qualified to do. That may be a reconciliation. So speaking of resentment, there's one of my favorite lines in the purport is in 331, Bhagavad Gita. The verse says, those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. And in the purport, Prabhupada says that what Krishna says is eternally true and that we should have faith in what he says. But there are some philosophers, they may even write comments in the Bhagavad Gita, but they don't have faith in Krishna. They'll never be liberated. Then he says, but an ordinary man with firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. So in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, that doesn't mean only when we joined. It may mean that we're still at the beginning after so many years and we can't fully discharge the injunctions. But this is an important point. We should not resent that Krishna is asking us to fully surrender to him. So how one does this, I guess, is an individual thing, so that it's sincere. You sincerely would like to do it, complete surrender, but you can't now. And how does that become not just a bluff or something? But that is our position. And of course, it requires to be very humble and realize that you haven't completed or perfected your Krishna consciousness. And then try, at least in some ways that are possible, to make moves in that direction of doing what Krishna wants you to do, not just what you want to do, even in the name of devotional service. Of course, Krishna sometimes, he does it himself. He sometimes arranges our life that, okay, now you're going to do this. And by providence, we just do it. And so at those times, we should sweetly submit and see that it is Krishna. But also by our free will, we have to do it. One way I've tried to encourage devotees is encourage them to do some service that they like to do, even if it's not the one that they were told to do by the temple leaders, and which they found that they couldn't do, but there was something they liked to do. There's nothing wrong with that. But then you have to be faithful to the chosen service and do the austerities within the chosen service. You know, you've made your bed, now lie in it. You heard that expression. So whatever you choose, it's your nature. You say, I want to do this for Krishna. All right. But then there are plenty of austerities in that and plenty of opportunities to be weak-hearted. And you shouldn't. You should continue to do it. And keep purifying the way you do it so it's really not your thing. It's just a thing that you happen to be good at or you like to do for Krishna. So you really make the offering an offering that he will accept. And then when you present it, you do it with trembling, hoping that Krishna will actually accept the tiny offering that you're making among so many other wonderful offerings that he's being given. These are some things that are within our reach to do. To be enthusiastic about what you perhaps find is the best thing that you can do, what you want to do for Krishna. There's no harm in that. But keeping in mind this goal that it should be one with the interest of Krishna. Let's see, I have a couple of other things on this theme. One is just another statement that of so many that you can find of these kind of perfections that are kind of beyond our reach too. This is the description of Devahuti after her son grows up and leaves home, and she's alone, and she meditates on him and prepares to go back to Godhead. So she's described, situated in eternal trance and freed from illusion, impelled by the modes of material nature, she forgot her material body just as one forgets his different bodies in a dream. So here's the ultimate stages again. And I was saying, when we hear these, don't resent it. That's one thing. That's saying, why am I being asked to do that? Why can't I do what I want to do? What is this complete giving up of all interest in? Don't resent it, even if you can't do it. And then also, don't think it's impossible, and don't think it's undesirable. Okay, so here's a description in the purport of that state that Devahuti reached. This forgetfulness of material body occurs when one renders service unto the Lord. A devotee no longer works with the body for sense gratification with family, society, country, humanity, and so on. He simply works for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. That is perfect Krishna consciousness. So, I repeat again. In ISKCON, you'll see that more and more there is like a return to reevaluating. Maybe we do have something to do with family, with society, with country and humanity, and to be more whole and realistic, we should address these things and not just be fanatical preachers and so on. So that's good. That's kind of a sign of the maturing of our movement. But at the same time, we should never forget that, and if you read Prabhupada's books, you won't forget that ultimately, one disconnects from all these services and only serves Krishna. But how to do that, it doesn't mean necessarily by, as I say, kicking off these things, but learning how to do it for Krishna. He simply works for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is perfect Krishna consciousness. A devotee always merges in transcendental happiness, and therefore he has no experience of material distresses. This transcendental happiness is called eternal bliss. So this would be an item for don't think it's impossible. How could it be possible not to have material distress? But it is. According to the opinion of devotees, constant remembrance of the Supreme Lord is called samadhi, or trance. If one is constantly in trance, there is no possibility of his being attacked or even touched by the modes of material nature. As soon as one is freed from the contamination of the three material modes, he no longer has to take birth to transmigrate from one form to another in this material world. In his preaching, Srila Prabhupada didn't place these things as way beyond the reach of his devotees. But he encouraged us that they were attainable. I have a little excerpt from a lecture that I heard just today, where he's speaking about this, and he's speaking about Rupa Goswami's verse that if you hear that pure love of God is available in the market for sale, you should buy it. And then he discusses what the price is.
£100, £200, £1 million, £1 billion, like that. The price is different. Here Rupa Goswami says that you price, you purchase at any price. But what is that price? Tattal lullam ekalam. Lullam, ignorance. That is price. That is the only quality. You must be very, very eager to see the lotus feet of Krishna in his very life. You must be very eager to talk with Krishna in his very life, but not to become sahaja. By service, Krishna talks with the devotee, but not with non-devotee. He says in the Bhagavad Gita, Tesam satadriptanam bhajatam priti purva. Only persons who are always engaged in Krishna's service. He has no other business. Satata means 24 hours. He has no other business. Tesam satadriptanam bhajatam. Bhajatam means in service. You must find out always some opportunity how to render service to Krishna. That is the qualification. It doesn't matter what you are. You may be this or that, it doesn't matter. But this eagerness for service can be acquired by anyone simply by sincerity. That is the pride in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
You see how practical he is about it, saying that because if you just say you should think of Krishna every hour, every second, and never cease serving Krishna, never have any separate interest, that can sound like an impossible thing. But Prabhupada just keeps emphasizing it's a practical service that we do, and the details of the carrying out of that service can absorb any one of us in Krishna consciousness throughout the day. So this was Prabhupada's expertise in teaching an active kind of self-realization. I can remember when I was much younger and was practicing Krishna consciousness and temple president in Boston, and how it would be like that, although maybe not so deep inwardly and not free of material desires, yet even to the point of stressfulness and material exhaustion, you would be always doing something for Prabhupada's movement, for the temple and so on. You have a project that's so demanding that you can't do anything but serve Krishna. You can just barely keep up with it. So, that's good. There's no time for Maya. And if we're not able to keep that pace later, we have to find another way to be Krishna conscious. Maybe you have some questions or comments. I said that in the beginning that I'd like to present something in an honest way rather than just speak about the perfection. Even if you do only speak about the perfection in a lecture, once you ask for questions, then you'll be forced to, the devotees will say, yeah, but how can I do this? But then sometimes the speaker doesn't descend to the level of the struggler and just gives more and more perfect answers, which he can do if he can do it honestly. I guess what I was trying to do today was kind of turn things around from what I usually do. I usually try to accommodate devotees' desires to do certain things for Krishna, and against stereotypes, ideas of full surrender. And today I was trying to emphasize the fact that full surrender is the siddhanta, or the conclusion. And even if we can't do it, it should never be out of our vision. Especially we shouldn't make a new philosophy which eliminates this as the goal. And neither should it be so far from our thoughts to do only what Krishna wants us to do, and try to make that a reality. did I read here? Oh, it's in this book. Yeah, this is on the same point in the purport. The question may be raised that since the Lord is supposed to be worshipped by great demigods like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and others, how can an ordinary human being on this planet serve him? This is clearly explained by Prithu Maharaj by the use of the word yatadikara, according to one's ability. If one sincerely executes his occupational duty, that will be sufficient. One does not need to become like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Indra, Lord Chaitanya, or Ramanujacharya, whose capabilities are certainly far above ours. Even a Shudra, who is in the lowest stage of life, according to the material qualities, can achieve the same success. Anyone can become successful in devotional service, provided he displays no duplicity. It is explained here that one must be very frank and open-minded, amayana. To be situated in a lower status of life is not a disqualification for success in devotional service. To me, this idea of being frank and open-minded would include a kind of admittance to Krishna that I can't do this, what you're asking. Be completely pure and just do what you want without any thought of what is my own interest and without any let-up. But I don't like that I'm this way, and I wish to be your devotee, but I don't see how I could do it unless you give me the strength, and so on. To be frank and open. The only qualification is that whether one is a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, he must be open, frank, and free from reservations. Then by performing his particular occupational duty under the guidance of a proper spiritual master, he can achieve the highest success in life. So after admitting that you can't be a perfect devotee to Krishna, it's not like you say, therefore I won't do anything. But we say, so this is what I can do. I can make this offering of my occupational duty. Please accept it. So this is, Prabhupada is saying here that if you do that, you can be successful, even though you're not a Lord Chaitanya, you're not a Ramanujacharya. Then by performing his particular occupational duty, he can achieve the highest success. As confirmed by the Lord himself, Striyo Vaishas Tatas Sudras Tepiyanti Param Gatim. It does not matter what one is. Okay, anyone want to ask any questions or make any comments? It may take a process of trial and error. As I was saying, the classic way would be to follow some authority that
you assume you don't know. So your temple president, your GBC man, your spiritual master, he'll tell you what to do. And that may be according to the needs of the mission. That's particularly that would tend to ruffle people. Or even if they said, yes, that's good, that's the way we should do it, then when they attempt to follow it, they may find that it doesn't work. Somebody misled me. I wanted to go back to college, and my authority told me, that's Maya. And now 5 years later, he's going back to college. And I missed my opportunity. That can cause bitterness and lack of faith, and I'm not going to ask anybody else. I'm just going to figure out myself what to do. So that may not be so possible. I say trial and error. So the trial may be I try following somebody's advice of what I should do. And it may work or not. Then if it doesn't work, then I have to try myself, and I try something. And it may be that I'm mixing too much with the materialists, and I find right away, oh, I don't like this. I feel I'm becoming less, not even a devotee anymore. And I have a real taste for associating regularly with the devotees and the temple life. I can't do this other thing. It's too far out there. This is not my nature. But of course, that's not the best kind of answer to say trial and error. But it's certainly a way that we do things in life, I think. You have to develop a good conscience, and a sense of feeling when we're doing something that's good and possible for us or not. I think that takes a lot of maturing. I know in myself, I found a lot in my earlier years. I was almost always dissatisfied whatever I would be doing. If I was doing a lot of managing, I would be dissatisfied that I should be out preaching. And I was out, cut off from management and just be out preaching. I was thinking, why aren't I more having a say in what's going on in the society? And then at one point, I was even pointed out to me by a godbrother when I was complaining of my latest situation. He said, you seem to be always dissatisfied, whatever you're doing. So then I began to think about that and try to... because if that's the case, then you'll never be able to find what's good for you, because you'll always find something wrong with it that makes you think it's not what you want to do, and you're restless and you want to do something completely different. I think that's kind of immaturity. And so at some point... I don't know, maybe that exists because you're thinking that the perfect state, you're always supposed to be completely elated and feeling at every minute ecstatic. Yes, this is what I want to do. And it's always smooth sailing, and this is wonderful. But rather, the reality is, even when we choose the best varna and ashram, there still will be difficulties, and there'll be times when you feel not satisfied, but you have to continue with it. It's hard to say. I just know that for myself, at a certain point, you just more and more you stop doubting, and you start having convictions that this is it. This is what I'm going to offer. This is the best I can do, and not be dependent on just what's the most praised service in ISKCON, or what people say is the best thing to do. And you may even admit that yes, this is the best thing to do, but I can't do that. But I do this. And I like to do this, and this is a very good service too. So it's really a happy time when you find somebody like that who really loves what he's doing. You can think of different devotees like that. It just comes to my mind as Bhaktisiddhanta Prabhu, the artist in Vrindavan. He's just so happy. And he went through so much austerity, struggling himself to be an artist. Often he was criticized by management, and he kept trying to develop a little shop and get somebody to help him. And he went through all these disasters of trying to do things in India, and it didn't work out. And now he's got, dozens of workers, and he has his own property and huge projects. And everyone is doing things almost on a superhuman level. They're all painting and carving and everything and doing huge service, and he's so happy. So there's a happy man in his service, and you see they're happy pujaris and book distributors, and they're the really fortunate persons, and they can be in any service. So that's not certainly something to be grateful for when you find your niche, what you're somehow natural at, what you like to do. I think the balance will be, as you say, will be struck then, because you won't be so interested in developing a lot of material training and material skills or getting back into that sort of thing so much, because you'll have be so satisfied and certain that you're doing the right thing. You won't worry. A lot of it may be financial worries, and become dependent on Krishna, not so financially worried. But whatever it may be, you have to settle for it, settle at it, and go through the hard times. I don't have such a simple answer. There's not like one answer for all people how to find that balance. But I don't try to stop devotees. When I see a lot of the devotees I know who are almost militantly saying, you know, I was brainwashed for so long. I was just told what to do. I was told who my husband is. I was told how to think, and I was told this. And now I just feel like everything's exploding, and I'm just figuring out everything for myself. And sometimes I feel rebellious against what Krishna says, but sometimes I go back to just the old line of very dogmatically saying, you can't do this, you can't do this, and your devotee doesn't do this, and the devotee doesn't do that. When I see somebody bubbling like that and everything, I think you just have to let them go through it, but be their friend. And say, but if it's you going through that, then it's good if you have friends who aren't going to try to tell you at that time what you should do and what you shouldn't do, but just help you remember to chant and hear, and the real point is to be a devotee, right? Do these things that you want to do. It makes you a better person in order to become a better devotee, and so on. So it's not necessarily unhealthy to go back like that, but the spirit of complete of desirability of complete surrender to Krishna must be there.
Sort of honest with ourselves, knowing where it is, but we are, then have a whole different philosophy. Because as soon as someone develops a different philosophy, then they have to, in order to justify what they're doing, they have to attack the existing philosophy, and then it's almost finished. Whereas Krishna needs to reciprocate more with the devotee that's sort of struggling to attain that that highest standard.
Yeah, and when he changes the philosophy, then he can disrupt other people too. Say like one of the four rules is no illicit sex. So somebody may be having a problem with that, or no intoxication, and sincerely doesn't want to be at a lower standard, but he's from time to time has trouble with these old habits of his, and feels very fallen. Yeah. So the opposite would be to say, well, our philosophy really says that it's all right. There's this passage, and there's this letter, and there's this passage. And then it can be very disruptive. Or Prabhupada, he was mistaken. He shouldn't have taught this. This is a better philosophy. So those are very disruptive to everyone. Krishna won't like that. Changing the Acharya's teachings or teaching something opposed to it. rather than admitting that I can't keep the standard, and at the same time not being complacent about that, but making some kind of efforts to improve, come up. Is that your point? Krishna would appreciate not changing the philosophy, but just humbly admitting that you can't do it. Yeah, it's refreshing to hear somebody say that and admit it, rather than do something weird.
You might come to devotion services and we don't even know who we are or what our tendencies are, and then we have to try and find them. So one thing about having to try and find kind of like that who you are and what you want to do and what you're about. And the other aspect is you might have an idea, but then you might feel very scared to kind of break out of the mold that you're in. How do you kind of break that mold and take a big step out of everything that you know into something you don't even know?
I'll try not to just be answering for you, but in general, and for you at the same time. It's not wrong to come, especially when you can come at a young age, to Krishna consciousness, to at least for some time try to be like a blank slate and receive training in what is considered necessary for all devotees, and which may be spoken of as this is complete surrender, so you should do it, this is what's good for you. If you do that, even if later you find out that you couldn't keep it up, it can be a good foundation. This is the opposite story of the story that somebody says, oh, I was told to do this and it was all wrong, I did things against my nature for all these years. But rather to say, actually what I went through then was good for me. It was a higher level of surrender than I really could keep up, but I did it. Things like learning the basic philosophy of Krishna consciousness, to spend a lot of time on that is good. To read the books, just like a college student at that time in his life, he reads more and studies more than he ever will later in his life, intensely. So we should try to understand what Krishna consciousness is, theoretically by hearing and practically by serving. And so that the service can be not necessarily tailored to my nature, but just what is needful. And then we learn what it is to surrender and do what Krishna wants, as represented by the movement or the temple. If you can do that without any bitter disappointments, then it's good. And I'm saying so that after some years of that, then one might be in a better position to try to understand what now on a long-term basis. I've been a brahmachari or a brahmacharini and doing whatever the temple wanted for 5 years or so. Now, will I always be doing this? Or will I get married? And inevitably these things start to develop, the different natural desires. I think they come out more, and there may be more of an opportunity for them occurs, and so on. Like I know for myself, when I joined, I whether immaturely or not, I just rejected everything I was doing and just did the duties of for the spreading and maintaining the movement, and did that for 12 years or so. Then I started thinking of things that I might like to do, that actually were part of my nature. Then I didn't feel that was I feel rather it was a credit to what I did, even if it was against my nature. And perhaps by contrast, it even helped me to see better what my nature was once it started coming
clear. But it can be done sooner. Anyone have any? I'd like to help Sridhar with that question. Yeah. In my case, I think opportunities came too, and part of it was this illness that I got at one point. Psychologists could even say you get the illness because you're not working according to your nature. Your whole body gets sick. But I'll speak a little personally. Maybe it will help. That. I feel I always had had a strong desire to want to please people, and very conservative concept that you should just do what you're told, and what the leaders want. So it took me a long time and a lot of thinking, not maybe so long in time, but a lot of thinking and thinking about it. To change that, to thinking that I had a good amount of say in what I should do for Krishna, that it's not somebody else to tell me that. And how to reach that point without being rebellious or in Maya is something that a conservative person wants to be very careful about. But I suppose it was also helped in my case by all the people who were looked up to just all falling down and so on. This is the person who always told me to do that this was success. This is the person who told me that this is what success is, and this is the person who said you got to do this. And now they're all they're not doing it at all. So who am I going to ask now? Who am I going to please now? Certainly there are more people I can go to and ask, what should I do now? Please take care of my soul, direct me. But then I started thinking, well, nobody knows better than you yourself. So yeah, it's a risky proposition to start trusting yourself, and you shouldn't do it exclusively. But it has to come inevitably. You have to surrender yourself, not because somebody told you. But you should have friends who will, you know. Sympathize with you very much, be willing to listen to you and go along with you and what is your dilemma, and not make a quick judgment for you and say, oh yeah, don't listen to them, just go ahead and do it, or no, that's Maya, you should just do what you're told. But somebody who really understand that you're trying to understand, but you're not, you can do that yourself. You can just obey, or you can go and break ranks and do what you think you'd like to do, but you're trying to really think it out and try and look for some signs of what is best, what Krishna wants, or what you can best do for Krishna. Like Anuradha Singh, sometimes you get really clear signs because you're just put into another situation. So the thing that you may want to do, it should also it should have some spiritual reality to it. But there are some pretty far out things that devotees want to do. I know. And you can't just be stereotyped about it. Here in Ireland, I've seen devotees doing different things.
One of them is this devotee, Shilabhati, who was an actress before she was a devotee, and then in recent years, the desire came again, I want to be an actress. And I encouraged her, and she started going back to getting lessons, and then she got a part in a prominent play, a production in Dublin, and she was great. She got all these great reviews, and all the devotees were so happy for her. And when you hear her talk about it, she says how she's become more centered as a person, and her feels more solid about her conviction. And somebody wants to become a dancer, and somebody wants to become is a singer, and what can repression accomplish? So he's not repressing anymore. And I don't know, the time will come when you'll just be you won't be asking that question and you'll just know that is it better for me to do this or I gotta go ahead and do this. And you have to find out who are your real well-wishers too, and the people who are telling you what to do. There are always symptoms of good spiritual health, and we can, just like when you go for a physical checkup, they always do the same things. They take your blood pressure and feel your heart beat, all your life symptoms, the vital symptoms must always be checked no matter what. You may be going in there for one thing, but they always want to check these vital symptoms. So you have to check your vital spiritual symptoms, whether you feel enthusiastic to be a devotee, and definitely don't want to even consider giving up Krishna consciousness, and you're chanting and hearing and so on and so forth. And that will help you decide whether you're on the right path.
Sometimes it's a discomfort if your health was only according to your role. Although you're performing a certain service and you're doing a particular thing, but others can take that as being you, and when they deal with you, it's only on that basis. I was wondering if you could give any advice on how to deal with that, and also whether it's connected with your portrayal of the role. Just like you said, sometimes you feel that it's there's a certain amount of joking about the role, or alluding to the fact that this is just a role in a certain sense, and kind of breaking it down yourself in a proactive way.
Well, I don't think we can expect most people in our life to do other than treat us according to the role, because at least that's my experience. You can't have a lot of deep relationships with people. It's almost contradictory. How could you have many, many friends with whom you were very intimate and there's a lot of integrity to your relationships? The more and more people you have to deal with, you couldn't possibly do it unless you did it with some kind of a role. It's like, imagine someone like the Pope or the Catholic Church, all the different people he meets. He can't say, you know, well, I really feel like this. Sometimes I feel a lack of confidence, or sometimes he can't be like that with all the people. He can only, you know, bless them or do whatever he has to do. President of a country. More people you meet, the more demanding it is to be yourself. So that would be one thing. So then you just have to be, you know, cheerfully prosecute your role, and it can be meaningfully done with integrity, so that even the people you meet, they don't think, boy, that guy was so phony. He was just, you know, fulfilling his role. But rather, you really
are living the part. The more power you have, you can do that. A powerful person can keep his integrity. But others of us, like I find, when I deal with a lot of people socially, then I feel a need to get away from them. I feel that my real sense of self has been taxed too much, and I want to just be with myself so I don't have to just be bouncing off other people's opinions and so on, and just have more of a sense of my real self. So a lot of it is not just convincing people or that you're not your role and having a more intimate relationship with them, but at least having an intimate relationship with yourself so that you know who you are and what role you're playing. Yes, and I think there is a sense of humor involved. Often people who have a good, healthy sense of humor, a lot of it plays on that they not only they're playing a role, but they know that you're playing a role too. And there's good cheer about the inevitable role-playing that we have to do. We can relax instead of trying to always impress each other with some role that we want to project. And then there should be some people in your life, at least a few, who do know you beyond that, that you're not just a temple president or a such and such, and they know more about you and what your real likes and desires are and so on and so forth, and they encourage you in it. My main point in the talk was that hearing what full surrender is and not forgetting that. And but I do find that people, when people can do things that are very personal to them and which is creative activity for them, that can help them feel seek Krishna more. Like Prabhupada was saying, you should see, what was he saying, you can talk with Krishna in this lifetime and see Krishna in this lifetime. When you become a better adjusted person, and then I think it is good for us to do those things, even though they may not be the mainstream concept of how to see Krishna. So, the first thing is answering your question is, you have to find yourself aside from the role, and then you may see it with irony that that people are not, they don't know who you are and they just treat you like a role, but you at least you know that that's not exactly who you are, and you prefer to be with people or to be with no one so that you can have the actual life that you of who you are in serving Krishna. Why should we constantly go through artificial motions of what somebody thinks we are or something that's not real? So you find it yourself, and then you can learn how to deal with others, whether they know it or whether they appreciate you really or not. And it's obvious that the people who be your closest friends will be those who respect who you really are and have some they love you, and they have some interest, some genuine interest in the things that you're interested in.
Although you described out that doing what you want or what you're good at professionally could be called a lesser principle. In the letter you also presented the perspective that if you don't do what you want for Krishna, then when Krishna says Sarvadharma, give everything to me, there will be some things that you're not giving to Krishna. That seems to bring that position, it gives it a higher status.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I quoted Franz Kafka talking about Judaism, and he was praising it and saying, this is a religion which accepts the whole man or the whole person. So, not just that we give Krishna some saintly side of us, a virtuous side of us, but they give him everything that we have. In that letter, I was pointing out what I thought was realistic rather than idealistic, and only was that I don't always know what Krishna wants me to do, and even if I knew, I couldn't always do it. So that's why I'm doing the best I can using my intelligence, my God-given intelligence, to give everything I can to Krishna. And Prabhupada was saying in this tape, it doesn't matter what you are, he said, just always do some service to Krishna. So, that's encouraging. It's a full-time thing, devotional service. It's not just a hobby. And we can think of it as almost mysterious and very, very high-level esoteric thing to be completely surrendered and to always be thinking of Krishna. What in the world is it? What is it like? But Prabhupada brings it down to earth and says, you just have some service and always be doing your service and thinking about your service. Then you're always in Krishna consciousness, at least on some level. With the emphasis on service, vocation, whatever you want to call it, occupation of Krishna consciousness, then it behooves us to find out our service, and yes, one that we can really do, get into for Krishna, and then do it. There was one devotee, he was sort of aimless and not applying himself and anything so much, couldn't find anything he really liked to do. And another devotee said to him, what you need to do, you need to marry a project. The word marry. Obviously, if you marry, then that certainly defines your life in terms of that ashram. So many things you'll have to do then. So he used that word. You should marry a project. Meaning, you know, decide I'm going to dedicate myself to this temple or to this particular department in the mission, in the sense that I'm going to give my life to it. As when you get married, you do that in a personal relationship. You can do it also in service, rather than think that service is an unimportant thing. Sense the highest service is to chant Hare Krishna 24 hours a day like Haridas Thakur, but we can't do that. So we have to do other things according to our nature. I better go and save my energy for the next round.
Next is an excerpt from a question and answer session with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami on July 7th, 1999 in Dublin, Ireland.
So, one important point from this morning was that by a particular act of service, we can be fully Krishna conscious or full-time Krishna conscious, and that one has to find his or her particular service. It may not be the same service as somebody else. And I won't call it an idiosyncrasy what service we have, but it's still it fits our own personal nature, and then we contribute it to the Krishna consciousness movement. And I think a lot of my relationship with you is trying to encourage you as you find your service and as you have your service to continue it. So although we have different services, and it may be hard for somebody to relate to somebody else's service, somebody's sees Krishna in gardening, someone sees Krishna in Namhatta type preaching, someone sees Krishna somewhere else. But there's one service that we do, that we all do the same service. And it's maybe our most important service, and it's also personal. And that's our daily chanting, especially the vow we made to chant on our beads. 16 rounds. I remember the TM movement, they would get personal mantras, although actually they only had about six or so mantras they would give out again and again. But they would question us, "You only have one mantra for everybody?" Yes. But each person finds their very individual relationship with Krishna eventually by chanting this one mantra. And in our relationship, which has somehow been arranged in Parampara from Prabhupada, that I'm an important part of your spiritual life, and you're an important part of my spiritual life. Much of it has to do with our faithfulness in chanting or in trying to chant in the best way we can, with attention, and the best time in the day for it. Sometimes a struggle. So I thought we could chant around together. I told you I went to a Bhakti Briksha meeting, and it was held in Ireland, and I didn't know there's like a whole exact format that they follow from the book to do everything by the Bhakti Briksha book. The first thing they did was to have an icebreaker where each person has to say something on a particular topic. That was fun. When I was there, it was your first memory from your childhood that you can remember, or a very early one. So we all did that. And he said, "Now we're all going to chant around together." So I thought, okay, that's nice too. But then he said, "The way we chant," he said, "everyone has to chant in unison." And that was, at first I thought, what's this? Sounds like a guru cooler. But when I surrendered to it, it was all right. I'm not going to do that today. But it was not bad.
We did that at the Sunday Feast program in Kenya.
Oh, yeah?
All the guests, about 300 guests, all turned around and jumped.
In unison, yeah.
It took about 20 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Ram 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 Ram
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Speaking of counter beads, I think I've told that story that I asked Prabhupada in 1966, how can we, when we chant, how can we keep count of how many rounds we chant? Because up to then we didn't have these. And he said, the Vaishnavas count on the small beads. He said, if you get some small beads, I'll show you. So then I went out the same place where I got these other beads, Tandy's bead store. And I came back and gave them to him, and he said, he laughed. He said, oh, you're so prompt. And I thought, is he laughing at me? And I thought he was, that it's such a small virtue to be prompt compared to being surrendered to Krishna and being prompt about that after being in the material world so long and so many other things that one could be. At least you're prompt. But I think now any little virtue that mentionable by Prabhupada is worth it. Like Prabhupada says, even to be if you're kicked by Krishna, that's also a great thing. So if we can expand on these little virtues, be prompt to go back to Godhead. So Damodarati mentioned that she wanted to write some questions down. If anyone has written them down, I can take them. I can also take them verbally. Do you have anything written down? Wait. Okay. What if someone finds the service that fits their personal nature and they feel really happy and blissful when they do it, but external situation or obstacles don't allow them to perform the desired service? Well, without probing to find out personally what you mean, I would say in general that that you should try to overcome those obstacles. For example, say if this was the gopis, that they like to go to Krishna when he plays his flute, but they can't because their brothers and husbands stopped them. But they just went anyway, defying social convention and morality and so on. Of course, that's a special thing. I think it would be hard to answer this question without knowing the details because, for example, the external situation might be something that really doesn't allow you to perform it. And if that's the case, like I'm saying, don't let it stop you. Whatever it is, there should be nothing to stop you. Just go ahead and do it. Beg, borrow, steal, and break the law. Whatever you can do, do it. That's one way to answer the question. But if we say that this situation is one that you really can't do it, then find another way to do it. Maybe you can find another way to do it. Like I was thinking of some examples where people were not able to do certain things. Maybe they were physically handicapped, or there's an example of Therese of Lisieux, that in those days women didn't go out and preach. A woman's religious life was to live in the convent, but she wanted to save souls and preach.
So she did it by just by praying for those who were out there, praying that they could be strong and they could do it. And she even wrote to one priest who was like assigned to her, like a pen pal, and she encouraged him and prayed for all the preachers. So that's like doing the thing that you want to do within your limits. You can think about it, let's say. If you can't go to Vrindavan and live in Vrindavan, you can try to create a Vrindavan-like atmosphere and think of Vrindavan. And because this is such a wonderful thing to find something that fits your nature and makes you happy when you do it, that you really should try to find a way to do it. For example, say it was deity worship and you couldn't worship in the temple, and you could do deity worship in your home, or something like that. Another way to do it, even without doing it in a normal way. And perhaps also examine that. What is this obstacle, and can this obstacle be overcome? Otherwise, we have to just, as much as we like it, just, you know, put it aside and do something else, and kind of keep a dream that maybe, although I can't do it now, maybe someday this is what I'd really like to do. Like a mother who had to take care of her children and couldn't do what she wanted to do. Well, in the future when they grow up and they leave, then you can do it. And keep it as a desire. Anyone else like to comment about this? Not being able to do the thing that you really like to do because of external situation.
The gopis, how they were able to break through all of those constraints. Some of them,
yeah.
I think I remember, they even left their bodies because they were restricted from going to meet Krishna, and they just
they
were unstoppable in a sense. I think like one verse that you put
somehow. Yeah, right.
Cross
the bridge of family relationships and both of you, one at a time.
I was trying to understand about Krishna protecting us, and where we can draw the line about how much Krishna protects us and how much we have to protect ourselves. I think a specific example can make an answer from that. Like, for example, when I go to the morning program, in the morning, it's quite dangerous where we live, so if I have to go by myself, my sister thinks it's better if I don't go, because she thinks it's quite dangerous. And I think it's like a Christian protecting me from the ego, and but her feeling is that I'm protected, guarding that I should go. So where do we draw the line between the Christian and protector?
Well, if you say protect yourself, so like if your sister is telling you not to go, that's saying not protect it, not depend on Krishna, but it is. It's also because you're Krishna's devotee or Krishna's servant, so you should be protected. You're a woman, you should be protected.
So that's to be done not just by Krishna. Like in the Vedic society, we know women are supposed to be protected by their father, and then protected by their husband, and then their son. Well, you say, well, why make an arrangement like that? Just let Krishna protect her. But no, all these other persons are assigned to protect. And the Kshatriya protects the citizens, and the Vaishya protects the cows. So this is also, that's Krishna's desire, that these people be protected. But he just doesn't say, because I want them protected, I'll do it, and I won't do it through any agents. I won't ask anybody to make any arrangements. Rather, he does. And when they fail, then it becomes very unfortunate that the cows are not protected, the women are not protected, the citizens are not protected. So, I don't think we should just throw all caution to the wind what are sane guidelines for security, and say that that's like asking Krishna to do some bodyguard work or something.